So welcome to a very different and special episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And this week we're going to do something different from the Second World War. On Easter Monday, the 10th of April 1944, my mother was just 6.5 years old, and she lived in a small village called Bicker in Lincolnshire near the town of Boston. And at just after 11 o'clock, her and her family heard the noise of a Lancaster bomber going over the top of the small bungalow that they lived in, but it was on fire. This Lancaster had taken off from Downham Market, RAF Downham Market in Norfolk, not far away, at 11:58 a.m. And it was on a training exercise. Just a few minutes after my mum and everybody else in the village of Bicker saw the plane on flames, it crashed into a nearby field. It was a devastating impact. Much of the aircraft was buried in the field, and all of the crew were, of course, killed. But worse than that, only one of the crew was salvaged from the wreckage. He was found in a tree, wrapped in his parachute. The rest of those young men, who we'll talk about today, are still there, buried deep beneath that field. The plane was so destroyed and so deeply buried in the field that none of the remains, other than Thomas Wilson, who was in the tree, were recovered. So Wilson himself is buried in a Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery in Harrogate, and the others are remembered on the Runnymede Memorial to the Missing. Now, in this podcast today, we're going to go to two simultaneous events that were held to commemorate the crew of that Lancaster. One of the events was held in Harrogate at the grave of Thomas Wilson, and the other was held at the crash site near Donnington, near Bicker, two villages close to each other in Lincolnshire. And I attended that ceremony with my mum and also another gentleman called Les Staples, who also saw and witnessed the Lancaster crashing. And we're going to start by going over to Harrogate, and we're going to listen to the ceremony that was organised. Both ceremonies were organised by a man called Tim Webster, and it was his parents that established and looked after the memorial on the crash site at Donnington. And Tim has now taken on the mantle of looking after that memorial and making sure that we remember what happened on that spring day 80 years ago. And the ceremony was carried out. It began at 10:58 a.m, which was exactly the time that the Lancaster left Downham Market. And it finished simultaneously at 11:20, precisely the moment that the plane crashed in that field. So as I say, we're going to start with Tim, and then when Tim finishes, we're going to go over to the ceremony that was held simultaneously in Bicker, and we're going to hear from the people that actually saw what happened on that day.
We're at the Commonwealth War Graves Cemetery at Stonefall, Harrogate. The reason why we're here is 80 years ago today, at 11:20, a Lancaster bomber crashed near the village of Lincolnshire, sadly with the loss of all crew. The body of the navigator was the only body recovered, and that was Thomas Ferguson Wilson, who's commemorated over there on the grave. And it's always been a bit of an interest of mine, originally having time spent in the village and since I moved back to Yorkshire, in seeking out his grave. And I kind of thought, because he is separated from his crewmates, that on today, the 80th anniversary of his death and the 80th anniversary of the crash, we needed to mark his death, his grave, at this cemetery. So I've arranged a simultaneous service because my parents look after the grave at Bicker. I'll look after the memorial at Bicker. So at 11:20, when we laid the wreaths here, they had a similar service going on in the village on the crash site. So we brought both Thomas Wilson, the navigator, and his crew back together for this occasion. And welcome to Stonefall Cemetery. We are gathered here today to mark the 80th anniversary of Lancaster bomber ND-820 of 635 Squadron Pathfinders crashing close to the village of Bicker, Lincolnshire, with the loss of all crew. This anniversary has also been commemorated today at the crash site near Bicker with a small wreath laying at 11:20, as we will, the moment of the crash. There will be also on Saturday a service by the village that will include several descendants of the crew. I'm told the family of Thomas Wilson will be there. I understand also today at Bicker, several witnesses to the crash will also be in attendance. Navigator Wilson was the only crew member who was recovered from the crash site. He and his crew members are remembered by a memorial built by the Lincolnshire Aircraft Recovery Group, which is maintained by my parents, hence my interest in this story. As a flight officer, Navigator Wilson was the only officer in the crew. The rest were sergeants and are listed on the Runnymede Memorial for the Missing. Their names were J.B. Barron, G.J. Ferrans, A. Hunter, R.T. Lord, R.H. Malthouse, and J.W. Nixon. The following biography has been sent to me by Laura McBride, who was Thomas Wilson's great-niece. On June the 22nd, 1917, Thomas Ferguson Wilson was born in the small village of Whitechurch, Ontario, Canada, a small farming village 200 kilometres west of Toronto, very close to Lake Huron. He was one of four children, being the youngest. The family ran a small lumber and planing mill as well as the family farm. Tom grew up with an interest in intellectual hobbies like photography, the radio and map making. He also liked to play softball and football. He helped around the homestead and sawmill. Tom was of average height, had bright blue eyes, and was very funny and brilliant, according to his sister. He was very close to his siblings, especially the sister closest in age, Agnes. Tom was identified as extremely intelligent and fun-loving from an early age. The village of Whitechurch did not have a high school, so the academically gifted Wilson children were sent to board with a cousin in the nearby town. Thomas received his elementary school education, then attended high school, graduating in 1934. He then headed off to a teacher's college a few hours away. In 1936, he graduated from the Stratford Normal School, which was a teacher's college. This was one of the few options for post-secondary education for Canadians. Stratford was far away from home, and Tom would take the train back to Whitechurch whenever he could. From 1938 until his enlistment, he took a wireless telegraphy course at the Radio College in Canada. At the age of 19, he was a public school teacher. Then at the very young age of 22, he was the principal, or the headmaster, at West Wanosh Public School. In January of 1941, Thomas voluntarily enlisted for the Royal Canadian Air Force. A recommendation from his Presbyterian minister described Tom as a highly principled boy, his conduct leaving nothing to be desired. Tom married in 1942 to a lady called Lorraine. She stayed with the Wilson family after he departed from England. Though Tom never got to meet him, Lorraine and he had a son named Terence, Terry, who is still with us. Terry and his wife are now retired and are enjoying life as grandparents. All three of Tom's siblings live long lives and remain very tight-knit, living well into their 90s. His older brother James works at the sawmill and farm until his retirement, raising five children. His sisters both continued their post-secondary education, becoming nurses. His sister Agnes worked in the nursing veterans care and lived to almost 99 years old. Terry, that is Tom's son, remembers that for decades, Tom's wife stayed in touch with a volunteer from Harrogate who gave her own time to care for the site where Tom's body is laid for rest. The family always appreciated the thoughtfulness. Though most of the details of the accident remain unknown to Terry, the son, and the rest of the family until recently, the family are deeply grateful for the people of Harrogate and for those in Bicker. On behalf of the family, they are so grateful for the care and love that they have received in honouring Tom and keeping the love of this bright man in their hearts. Squadron records indicate that this crew was one of the happiest and close-knit in the squadron. A brief bit of history about the crash before we move on to the next part. The aircraft itself was new to the squadron, which had been formed less than a fortnight before the crash. On a previous occasion, the aircraft had had a fault flying at 8,000 feet. It had been flown by the commanding officer and it spiralled out of control. Thankfully, on that occasion, the commanding officer was able to recover the aircraft from its dive. Sadly, however, 80 years ago today, at 10:58, the moment we started our service. The aircraft lifted off from the runway at Downham Market. The weather was clear, but there was freezing above 5,000 feet. The aircraft was travelling at 8,000 feet on the first leg of the exercise when it suddenly dived. The pilot was not able to recover. The aircraft crashing close next to the village of Bickett in Lincolnshire. Near the crash site, there is a tree at a 45-degree angle, and I believe that was caused by the blast from the aircraft. A local farm labourer was actually sheltering behind the tree and saved by the tree. 60 years ago today, or 60 years ago from the crash, or 20 years ago from now, a memorial was unveiled by the Lincolnshire Aircraft Recovery Group to one of those who were lost in the crash. The other six crew members still lie with their aircraft at Mill Lane, Bicker. So today, on behalf of the residents of Bicker, I will be laying a wreath. We've got RAF veteran Brian Shields here to lay one on behalf of the Wilson family. We've also got representatives of the Royal Air Force Association and Flowers to the Fallen will also be laying wreaths. So thank you all again for attending.
To them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them. We will remember them.
I don't know about you, but as I listened to that for the first time there, it did bring a lump to my throat. I've known about this story all through my life, and incredibly, the day after the accident, my mum and her dad went to the crash site and they picked up two pieces of the Lancaster, which have been in our possession ever since and always will be. We took them with us to the crash site yesterday and we showed them to the people that were there after the ceremony had finished. And that's where we're going to go now. Oh, just one thing, when I listened back to the ceremony there in Harrogate, as Tim was speaking, no doubt, like me, you could hear the birdsong in the background. It really did make it even more emotional. So let's now go to the crash site in Bicker and see what happened there. And as I say, this event was carried out simultaneously to the one that we've just listened to in Harrogate. So I'm here with a couple of people that were on the spot, were eyewitnesses to the Lancaster going down here. First of all, I've got Les Staples. And how old were you, Les, when you witnessed this accident?
I was 13 years of age.
Yeah, and do you want to tell us about it? What were you doing that morning?
That morning, it was Easter Monday. I was at home with my parents, who kept a shop in the village of Bicker. As the plane flies, about a mile away.
Yeah.
And they,
did you hear it then?
We heard the plane go over, very, very low, and then we heard the crash.
Okay, and what did you do then?
I came out of the house. I saw a cloud of smoke and thing going up into the air. I jumped on my bike, and within a matter of minutes, I was here at the actual crash site.
And what did you see then when you got here?
When I got here, all there was one massive crater and a lot of debris. But in the tree behind me now, there was a parachute hanging in that tree.
Right. And do you think that somebody tried to parachute out of the plane?
That's more than possible, likely, yeah. Yeah.
And was it still smoking? Was there any fire?
Yes. And then emergency services started to arrive, but I was here before any emergency services.
You were probably the first one on the spot then, yeah?
Almost.
Yeah. What happened then? Did they manage to... They didn't find anybody then,
no,
did they?
No,
apart from
no,
one man
no,
who was in the tree.
That's right, yeah.
And I'm here also with Mary Wenham, that was known as Evie Bowles at the time. And I hear a rumour that you might be my mother, is that right? And what's your memories of it? You were only six, weren't you? Six and a half?
Yes. Well, my sister and I, we were outside our gate with Dad. And he found some sweets for us. So we, all of a sudden, we heard this terrible roar. And we looked up and there was this aeroplane smoke and fire coming from it. And Dad said, "Oh, that's not going to go much further." And he'd no sooner said further than down it went. And that was it. And then we went the following day, on the Sunday, to the crash site.
Yeah, where we're standing now.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you remember much about that?
Well, I wandered off as nosy ones do. And I saw this helmet in the ditch, and I said to Dad, "Look, there's a helmet. Come here, he said. And it was one of the crew's heads.
It was the only one, wasn't it?
Yes.
It was the only body that was that was found.
Yes.
Okay, thank you for that. Well, the ceremony's about to start, so we'll see what happens next. So it's just approaching 11 o'clock on the 10th of April. And the service that we're going to listen to will be led by the Reverend Luke Smith, who's the minister of the Methodist Church in Bicker, nearby village.
Welcome to this brief service of remembrance as we gather on the 80th anniversary. I am amazed that we have a gentleman who wasn't even a toddler, he was a teenager when this happened, so can tell us firsthand exactly what happened, which is absolutely amazing. I hope everyone's got a copy of the order of service. It was on the 10th of April 1944 at 10:58 hours, the Lancaster Mark III ND820 from 635 Squadron took off from RAF Down and Market on a training flight. During the flight, it got into difficulties and caught fire over Swineshead. It crashed here in Bicker at 11:20 hours. All of the crew were killed. The only body recovered was that of Flying Officer Thomas Wilson. Thomas served as a navigator. He's buried in Harrogate Stonewall Cemetery. And this morning, remember all of the crew whose lives were cut short those 80 years ago today. A ceremony is being held in Harrogate at the same time as ours today. We meet this morning in the presence of God to remember the members of the crew and their families and to thank God for the sacrifice that they made. We also see this as a time to reflect and pray for all victims of war around the world and to pray for peace. Let us pray. Almighty God, as we gather here this morning, we are aware of your presence. We are aware that we meet in the context of a church service. And Lord, we do thank you for the contribution made by this crew and other people who gave so much that we can have freedom. And Lord, we do confess the times when we have added to war and arguments and conflict. Conflict in our families, conflict in our communities, conflict in our country. Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayer. Amen. I am not really from much of a military background, I'm afraid. One of my grandfathers was, and I don't know the story, was not fit enough for military service. He lived to be about 96, so I'm not quite sure what that was going on there. My father was too young to serve as to do national service, but my other grandfather was a soldier, and he was a career soldier. He never really left the army, to be perfectly honest. He always shined his boots. He was always ready for action. He was a regular churchgoer. He would go regularly on Remembrance Sunday. That was his church attendance. And but my nana, and I remember my granddad passed away when I was about 16. My nana had this portrait above the fireplace. And this portrait sits in my study. It is a portrait of my grandfather painted by a prisoner of war. My grandfather was involved in overseeing a labour camp. And so as a child, I was always intrigued by this picture. And of course, the difficult thing was that my granddad was one of those people who never really talked about what happened in the war. So since he's passed away and since my nana passed away, when I look at this picture, this portrait, I am just full of more and more questions. What really happened? How do the inhabitants of a labour camp get to the stage of doing a portrait of the people who were in charge? And I'm sure, you know, I'm a good looking lad, and I'm sure I get my good looks from my grandfather, but actually I think there was a lot of artistic license. When you look at the portrait and you look at the photographs I've seen of him, I think, you know, they were trying to get on my grandfather's good side. But I've often wondered where the grandchildren are of the artist. I've often wondered what their story is. Do they have such a wonderful memory of their grandfathers as I have of mine? What is the story? Did they survive the labour camp? What happened? We just don't know. Where did the materials come from to do the portrait? And all these things, where the frame and all the rest of it. So I am just absolutely amazed that we have this gentleman here today who was 13 when this happened, so can actually remember what happened. And of course, we do know that all of the crew sadly perished. So what story do their families have? What story do their families have? As time goes on, it becomes increasingly difficult to hear from people firsthand of what happened during the Second World War. I remember when I was a child, we used to hear stories of people from the First World War. And now, of course, we listen to stories from the Second World War. But there are so many questions. I cannot imagine the feelings that the crew went through when they realised their fate. When they realised that this was, and I believe it was a training flight. It weren't even shot down by an enemy. It wasn't supposed to be like this. It wasn't supposed to be like this. And so it is so vital that we continue to meet. We continue to meet to remember this absolutely unbelievable sacrifice. And of course, the story that there is, you know, one of the crew is in the cemetery in Harrogate, and this is the resting place of the other members of the crew. It is again. I have more questions than answers. I have more questions than answers. And you know, I don't know. I didn't live through the Second World War, but it must have been one of those times where actually the war came to your doorstep. It was real. It was real, and it came to your doorstep. And so this morning, I'm trying to sink it so that at 20 past 11 we lay the wreaths at the same time as our friends in Harrogate. But we do remember those people who gave, and remember those people who continue to give. I'm not sure, to be perfectly honest, that it would suit me, military service, you know, but you know, I do take my hat off and I do appreciate all those people that have done and do give so much. Amen.
And then, as we waited for the clock to tick down to 11:20 to coincide with what was happening further north, Les Staples, who we heard from earlier, our eyewitness, he gave us a little bit more information about what he saw and how he felt about it in retrospect.
In front of me now, where I'm standing, there was just one big crater. This road was still intact, What I would like to say is that at the time I was a schoolboy at what was then Donington Grammar School. It of course was wartime. I was too young at that time to serve in the armed forces, but when I became 18 I was called up to do my national service, and I am pleased to say that I did serve my king at that time in national service, and I'm proud to wear a veteran's badge. So I have lots of memories, but the one memory I have is, and you've just reminded me, above the fireplace in my bungalow over there near Lincoln now, I've got a painting of a Lancaster bomber. And that is my pride and joy. And that painting is willed to go when I go to my son. And it will always be a memory of Bomber County and the Lancaster. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Les.
Just now, as the time approaches 11:20, but Harrogate, a leaf wreath will be laid at the grave. Flight Officer F.F. Wilson, and here at the place where that Lancaster crashed exactly at this moment, 80 years ago. People are waiting for that moment. A simple white cross on top of a brick cairn. Someone's put a painted white stone at the base of it, surrounded by a chain supported by four white posts. And now Les Staples and my own mum, carefully given their age, make their way forward and lay British Legion wreath at the base of the grave, bow, pay their respects. Very carefully they support each other. And another wreath will be laid at the base of the memorial as we remember the crew of that Lancaster that at this moment lost their lives on this spot.
They shall not grow old, as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them.
We will remember them.
Thank you.
pray for all who have given their lives for the freedom of humanity, for those who have suffered and still suffer, for those who mourn, and for those who devote their lives to the service of the less fortunate than themselves. Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayer.
To conclude the service, we then sang the first verse of the National Anthem. But as I was holding the microphone and singing, I'm not going to put you through the torture of listening to my poor singing voice. And the one thing, I'm not sure whether you could hear it in the background, but just as they went to lay the wreaths and made their way back to their positions, there was a rumble overhead, and someone had kindly arranged for a modern aeroplane, an RAF or a United States Air Force aeroplane, not sure which. It flew overhead, and the sound of it brought back those memories for my mum and Les Staples, and it left them extremely emotional. As we went on our way, as we thought about those seven young men that gave their lives that day, we will always remember them, won't we? So in the second part of this week's podcast, we talked to Megan Maltby from the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. And the reason that I spoke to Megan this week was because the Commission have just started advertising War Graves Week, which is coming up in a few weeks' time in May. So I talked to Megan and she explained to me what War Graves Week was all about and how people can get involved in this, which is now, I think, in its fourth year. So welcome to the podcast, Megan. It's great to see you. And before we go any further, can you just explain to everyone who you are and what your job is?
Absolutely. So my name's Megan and I am the Public Engagement Manager at the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. My job entails a whole host of brilliant things, but the main part of it is overseeing our education and outreach work here in the UK. I manage our team of fantastic public engagement coordinators who are based all up and down the country, and I'm also responsible for outreach programmes at Brookwood Military Cemetery and the Runnymede Air Forces Memorial as well. There's always a lot going on, but it's and I get to meet lots of really, really interesting people. So
yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I suppose we ought to, some people who haven't come across the Commonwealth War Graves Commission before, we ought to just give a bit of a background about the commission, who the commission are, and specifically the role in the UK, or the role in the, what's different about the commission's cemeteries and commemorations in the UK as opposed to abroad.
Yeah, absolutely. So for those listeners who don't know, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission is the organisation that looks after the 1.7 million graves and memorials of the men and women who gave their lives during the two world wars. And we do this in over 150 countries and territories in over 23,000 locations. So we really are a global organisation who are still very much working today, maintaining those cemeteries and memorials worldwide. Specifically here in the UK, our work looks a little bit different. The policy of non-repatriation during the First World War meant that those that are buried here in the UK, for a large majority, the UK was their home. And we, of course, have a number of men and women buried here in the UK who came from overseas. But it meant that the rules around where you were buried was quite different in the UK. So what that means in the UK is that we have war graves in over 12,000 locations all across the country. And you will find war graves in kind of any given churchyard or local cemetery where there may just be one Commonwealth war grave. We, of course, have much larger plots. I mentioned Brookwood Military Cemetery, where we have thousands and thousands of burials, as well as a number commemorated on memorials. But what you'll find is that the cemetery locations are all often a lot smaller, and you won't find the key features that lots of people are familiar with if they visited our sites in France and Belgium.
Because a lot of them are in like village churches, aren't they? Village churchyards. And most of them, even if there isn't a stone of remembrance or a cross of sacrifice because they're too small, there'll still be a little green Commonwealth War Graves Commission plaque on the wall or the gate outside the church, isn't there? That's always a giveaway.
Absolutely. So that was a project that we really started pushing probably about 5 or 6 years ago now to really make sure that people were aware of the war graves in their local area. So that project's still ongoing. So there's some people thinking, oh, there's some war graves in my cemetery and there's no sign.
I'm sure you're
probably in progress somewhere. Yeah. But the aim is that every location at which there is a war grave in the UK is that there will be one of those little green signs.
Even if there's just one burial.
Even if there's just one burial, yeah. So those are the unique signs that say there is a Commonwealth war grave at this location. So yeah.
And is Brookwood the largest plot then?
Brookwood is the largest Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery in the
In the
UK, yes.
UK, And we mentioned Runnymede, and Runnymede is the memorial to the RAF missing.
Yes, so Runnymede is the memorial to the missing of the Royal Air Force from the Second World War. So there are over 20,000 names on the memorial of men and women who were killed on overseas operations. So those based here in the UK, but also those based in North and Eastern Europe during the Second World War.
And so then we come around to War Graves Week, and I think this is what, third or fourth year been doing it? Fourth year, is it? The first year was like a pilot, wasn't it? So it must be,
Was.
yes. So what exactly is War Graves Week then? What inspired this?
So War Graves Week began, yes, 4 years ago. So it was first piloted in 2021. So as you can imagine, starting that year, we were still under a number of COVID restrictions at the time. We thought we will try this in the UK as a starting point and to have the activity taking place outdoors, which is obviously what we were allowed to do at the time. And really, we wanted to take this opportunity in May around the anniversary of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission's kind of inception, 17th of May, that is, to really talk about ourselves as an organisation. So lots of people hear our name around Remembrance or around November. You hear a lot about the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. But actually, we wanted to take an opportunity outside of Remembrance, really to talk about who we are and what we do and engage with the public in sites that are very local to them. So whilst we're always encouraging people to visit our sites all across the world, you know, when they're on their holidays and everything, we really want to think about what might be on their doorstep, whether they live here in the UK or overseas. So what we started with was just really to raise awareness of who we are and to engage with the local community. And since then, War Graves Week has continued to grow outside of the UK. So this year, 4 years on, we have events taking place actually all across the world. So not only do we have events in the UK, which I'll talk in a bit more detail about in a moment, but we have events taking place in France, Belgium, the Netherlands, Malta, Italy, much further afield from where I am right now in the UK. And we also have events taking place in Ghana, South Africa,
Oh, really?
Bangladesh, really just to name a few, but our colleagues who look after the cemeteries all across the world have really embraced this opportunity to engage with the local public with what they do, but also really importantly to engage with schools, colleges, universities during this week. So there's a lot of incredible events and activity taking place during the week, and for the first time, we've also got events in Canada as well. So we've got an event taking place there.
So when it's abroad, then is it, it's not, you haven't got the program of volunteers that you've got in the United Kingdom. These are like maybe contractors that are working in the cemeteries, are they?
So they are Commonwealth War Graves Commission staff, but they are our staff whose really their main job is to maintain either a particular cemetery or in some country managers. So they might be responsible for the entire country. So they are staff employed by the commission, but their role is generally more operational. We found is that what they found in these cemeteries is that they talk to people all day long.
They do.
I'm sure yourself, having visited so many sites, often, you know, talking to the gardeners is one of the really interesting things to do when a commission site. So really, we found the operational teams all across the world have really embraced this because they know people are interested, so they want to put on something special to say, you know, thank you to all the people that, you know, visit day in,
Brilliant.
day out and come and learn something a bit different during War Graves
It's
Week.
also expanding their role as well, isn't it? And expanding their skills. And it means that, you know, they stand there week after week, month after month, looking at a particular headstone, and they probably know the story of that. And then they can tell, that can widen that story so that loads of other people know about it as well.
Absolutely. And of course, they're caring for the graves and memorials day in, day out.
Very
And they
personal
will.
to them, aren't
Absolutely. They're,
they?
you know, for some of them, they feel like, you know, brothers, they feel like family, that the people that they're looking after. And of course, they want people to visit. They want people to come and talk to them and tell them about the graves. And for them, they meet a lot of people that are visiting relations. So they meet a lot of people that are
It's very
visiting
emotional
either
then, isn't it?
grandfather or, you know, an uncle for the first time. So for them, they really get to learn more about these individuals who they're seeing, you know, day to day.
Oh, that's brilliant. Fantastic. So in the UK then, is it, as you know, I'm a volunteer for the commission, and it's all volunteers, or mostly volunteers, is it, that are doing the tours up and down the country?
Yes, so this year, it is mainly volunteers doing tours up and down the country. So as I mentioned at the start, we have a team of public engagement coordinators who are based across the UK, who look after a lot of our outreach work and attending events, as well as doing all sorts of community engagement across their regions.
Yeah.
But they are totally ably supported by hundreds of volunteers now up and down the country. And a key thing that's taking place for Wargraves Week this year is our volunteer-led tours across England, Scotland and Wales this year. At the moment, we are set to have tours taking place at over 120 locations in the UK, which is phenomenal and really? The most we've ever done. So it's really continued to grow.
Yeah.
To having new volunteers come on board, but also existing volunteers taking on new locations as well.
Yes, yes. I mean, here in Northampton, we've done two or three cemeteries in the past, but then there's another one I found where there's like, I think there's 40 scattered graves there, all with some incredible stories there. They're not all marked by a Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone either. Some of them are private memorials. Why is that then? Why will people find a private memorial but the burial registered by the commission?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. And the question we get a lot, because it's very unique to here in the UK. So because the family were able to be involved in that kind of burial process here in the UK, what that means is that those that died here in the United Kingdom, their families were able to bring them home. And then they were also given the choice as to whether they wanted to mark that grave privately, something that they would themselves pay for and therefore continue the maintenance of, or if they wanted us to put a Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone at the head of the grave. So what you find today is a number of these private memorials all across the United Kingdom, which we are absolutely responsible for their records, as we are with all of the Commonwealth War Dead of the two world wars. And we're also responsible for making sure that these headstones remain legible. So they are private property because they are private memorials for that family. But we need to make sure that you can still read the name. So there's a whole process that goes on around this. But really, it's checking that those private memorials remain legible.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why people might see, you know, an unusual memorial, but still registered and known by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. So does it cost? Are we charging? Are the commission charging people for these tours, or are they free?
These tours are free. So War Graves Week is really our moment that we want to get as many people engaging with our work as possible. So for that reason, the tours are totally accessible. They're free tours. The public can book a ticket via our website through Eventbrite. So we do ask that people reserve tickets just so we can make sure, you know, that tour guides aren't overwhelmed with the amount of people on the tour. So we can, you know, things to do with health and safety.
Yes.
But so we ask people to reserve tickets, but they are free tickets.
Yes.
Now, if people wish to make a donation for their ticket to the Commonwealth War Graves Foundation, which is our charitable arm, which really the money that goes to the foundation allows us to continue these outreach and education programs, then people are able to do that through Eventbrite as well.
Yes. And can groups book tours? Can, you know, if there was a boys brigade or a school group or something, they could perhaps have their own separate tour, or would they be included with everybody else's?
Yes, they can absolutely do that. So if you are a group of, you know, say there's four of you and you want to go along to a tour, by all means, reserve four tickets through Eventbrite for War Graves Week. But if you think, oh, actually, I've seen a tour advertised, but there's a group of 30 of us that would really like to go, there is another link on our website that allows you to book private tours. Now, these, again, are still free. Again, there is a suggested donation for those, but it's by no means mandatory because we want these to be accessible, especially for youth groups and schools who we want to engage with. There's absolutely no charge or suggested donation for them. And people can book that through the website, and providing that there is a tour taking place nearby, so there's a long list of tours that they can have a look through, then they can book one of those at a date that suits them.
Yeah. What I didn't ask you right in the beginning was, when is this? When is War Graves Week?
That's a great question. I should have mentioned that as well. So War Graves Week this year is taking place from the 11th to the 19th of May.
Yeah.
So again, that is to coincide with the commission's birthday, so to speak, which is the 17th of May. And people can book tickets now. So the tickets are available.
Yep, they're all up on the website now, aren't they?
All up on the website now. So the place people need to go to is www.cwgc.org/WarGravesWeek. Or if they just head to the homepage, there'll be a button there that they can get to the tickets.
And I think they're broken down into locations within the United Kingdom, aren't they? So, you know, if it's London, you need to look for Southeast, and so on.
Exactly. So if people are thinking, oh, actually, I have really no idea where the tours might be near me, they can head to the website. It's broken down by region or by country, and they can find out what's happening near them.
And will it just be during that week, or will there be some of these tours later in the summer?
So Wargraves Week really kind of kicks off our tour guiding season here in the UK. So after Wargraves Week, we have a little bit of a break in June. People are still able to book private tours during this time if they wish to, but our public tours begin again in July. So they run from July all the way through to Remembrance in
In
November.
November, yeah.
So people can keep an eye on us if they think, oh, actually, I'm away during Wargraves Week. I don't want to miss out. There will be more tours advertised after Wargraves Week that people can book onto for the rest of the year.
And I know from previous experience that we do these in all weathers, don't we?
We do. So we ask people to come prepared.
Yeah.
We obviously do anything in dangerous weather conditions, but if there's a little bit of rain, we do still these tours do still go ahead. So we expect people to come in, a suitable walking shoe and with an umbrella.
I remember doing one in the evening, in a cemetery. I can't remember, it was last year or the year before. And in the distance, we could see the clouds rolling in. And I was desperately trying to get the tour finished before, and we just got it done before the heavens opened, and the whole place was flooded within about 5 minutes. But the show must
Yeah.
go on, mustn't it? That's what we're saying.
Absolutely,
Well,
absolutely.
but alternatively, it can also happen. It can still be warm in May as well, and people might want to bring a drink with them and stuff like that. And how long do the tours last?
So the duration of the tour will be advertised on the Eventbrite page when you get there. So it's worth reading through that detail. They last anywhere from about 45 to 90 minutes. It depends on the location as to how long that tour will be. So some of our locations, there are fewer Wargraves, so the tours are a little bit shorter. Somewhere like Brookwood, for example, they are an hour and a half just because there's a fair
So
distance
many.
to. But all of the details around kind of the meeting place and the accessibility of the cemeteries is all advertised on the event booking as well. So yeah, people can just read through that information so they can find out a bit more.
And some of these places will be suitable for disabled people, and some won't be, will they? It depends.
Absolutely.
I can think of one plot where all of the graves are in one place, and there's hardly any walking to be done at all. Whereas there's another cemetery in the same town, the graves are scattered all over the cemetery. It's very uneven and would be very difficult for someone with reduced mobility. So it really is just doing your research, isn't it, to find out what's going to be suitable for each individual person.
Absolutely, because as you say, a number of these graves aren't, they're not within commissioned cemeteries, so to speak. They are
No.
within churchyards.
In public
So
cemeteries.
exactly. So the vast majority of the area isn't something that we can, take
Can't
responsibility for
control it. No.
or be do anything about. So it's really important that people read that if they do have, mobility issues. But our tour guides are all trained to really be aware that there might be people that can reach some graves and not others. And we welcome everyone to come along, and if that just means people are sticking to the paths and can view the grave from a distance, it's important that people just let the tour guide know, and there's no problems at all. It's really open to anyone.
Yeah, definitely. That's what it's all about, isn't it? And what about you? Will you be doing some as well, personally?
Oh, I hope so. But I'm hoping that we can do some tours at Runnymede Air Forces Memorial. So I've got a brilliant team of volunteer tour guides at Brookwood who will be doing some tours there throughout the week. The other thing that I will be helping out at is our evening at Brookwood, which is our annual summer fundraiser for the Commonwealth War Graves Foundation. And it's set to be a lovely evening. So this is on Friday, the 17th of May. Tickets again are available now on our website. For the evening at Brookwood. But as I said, it's a musical evening. We have some headline acts from the D-Day Darlings is one of our headliners this year. So we're really setting in with the kind of Second World War theme, given the 80th anniversaries this year. So that's set to be a lovely evening.
It is. And is that
Definitely.
outdoors then? That would take
It is
place.
outdoors. It is outdoors. This will be our third year of running it. So far, the weather's held for us, so we're hoping that will be this. It will be the same again this year. But it's held in the Second World War Memorial at Brookwood. There's a big grassy area around the memorial, and so we say to people, bring picnic chairs, bring picnic blankets, You know, bring some food with you, and
Like you're
really
going
just
to a summer concert in anywhere in the UK. These things are
absolutely.
very popular these days. And presumably you'll be singing, will you? A Vera Lynn song or something?
No, I couldn't possibly do that to the general
That's not your
public.
strength then, like me.
It's not my strength, no.
Oh well, there's lots to look forward to there, isn't there? And can people, is there still opportunities if people are interested in becoming a volunteer for the commission then?
Absolutely. So the best way for people to find out about our current volunteer opportunities, again, is to head to our website. There is a link there for volunteer opportunities. So we have a number of programs here in the UK. So we obviously have our tour guide program, which of course you are one of them, Terry. And at the moment, we're not having any new volunteers because we're just about to start the season. But if people are interested, they can get in touch, and we'll pop them on the list. So we'll be in touch when the next round begins. We also have a speakers program, so volunteers who deliver talks on behalf of the commission about the work of the commission. And the regions we're looking for volunteers in are available on the website. So if you're in one of those counties, or towns, you can see what's available. Our other major program is the Eyes on Hands on program. So this is where we have volunteers who are responsible for both looking at the graves to make sure things like legibility, as I spoke about earlier, and doing some light touch maintenance as well. And again, if people are interested in that program, the locations where we're looking for volunteers are available on the website.
And I think there still are some, aren't there, when I last looked, because there's quite a few sort of remote areas in particular. And part of the Eyes on Hands on team in the East, we were at Wellingborough Cemetery this morning, and there was a team of like 15 of us were going to clean some of the headstones there. As it turned out, there was only three to clean, and when we touched one of them, it fell over.
Oh
So luckily, Chris Hawes was there, the maintenance man, but that just shows how important it is to have local people on the ground so that we can find out these problems and report it back to the commission, isn't it?
absolutely. And that's why it's so important that if the public are keen on getting involved with this program, is that they sign up through our official program,
And they get all the
because
training, don't they? They get training and
they get all the
guidance and
training,
work in a
helpers.
team.
Absolutely, and the guidance of how to do things properly, because we know that sometimes things aren't necessarily, you know, things like that do happen. So it's important that our volunteers are trained and they know what to do in those scenarios as well.
I think, in my point of view, it's I've been 3 years now with the commission as a volunteer, I think, through different roles. And it's been, if people are interested in getting involved, I would highly recommend it because when you leave work, you perhaps, you've been used to working in a team for many, many years, and it can be quite a lonely existence. People, I know lots of people that, about my age that have retired and they don't know what to do with themselves. They lose that network of friends and colleagues. And being part of the commission, it's such an invigorating atmosphere. Culture, I think, is the right thing because you're working amongst, lots of volunteers, but you've also got tremendous support from people like yourself and Simon Bendry, and the guys on Eyes on Hands On, and right throughout the organisation, there's lots of people that give you lots of support, and you do very much feel like you're working as a team, and you get that sort of respect and well, self-respect, I think, because it gives you something to get out of bed and go and do, doesn't it? It's been great.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so pleased to hear you feel that way about it all, Terry. And yeah, that's exactly what we want volunteers to feel like within the organisation, is there's so many different opportunities. We've now got across all of the programmes, well over, I think, close to 2,500 volunteers across the UK.
Really?
As we organise meetups with the volunteers so they can get to know the other is locally, and obviously with the roles that you do as well, you have the pleasure of interacting with the public and getting to hear their questions and the people in a different
That
way
can
as
be
well.
quite interesting at times.
It
No question is a daft question, is it?
can.
And it's a big change. Seriously, it is a big change for the commission as well, because until recently, the commission has never really used volunteers, have they? I mean, the commission is centrally funded by government, so it's owned by the people. But it's only this is a new development, really, isn't it? Over the last 3 or 4 years, and it's been obviously it's been successful for the commission there.
It's been incredibly successful. We piloted public engagement in the UK in 2017, and we first piloted it in Scotland. And what we learned from that is that people were really interested in what we were doing. And so that has expanded since. So now that started with one public engagement coordinator in Scotland. There are now 10 across the UK, and we're expanding our outreach team across the world. world as well. So we know that there are people, especially young people, within schools and within universities who want to learn more. And what we're really trying to do as a team is to engage with those people so that they have the resources that they need to kind of continue their journey to not only learning more about the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, but within the context of the two world wars as well. And volunteers have really enabled the public engagement team I'm speaking about specifically in this instance to reach a much wider pool across the country. As a team of 10 who all work part-time, there is a limit to the amount of people they can talk to, you know, throughout the year. And by having, I think we're now around 240 speaker volunteers, and I think well over 100 volunteer tour guides, we are able to engage with so many more people all across the country. And it's been phenomenal. The amount of people that come away from tours saying that they've got a better understanding of the work of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, and also the amount of people that are saying that their tour guide was absolutely excellent and they've lived by this cemetery for years and they've never known about it.
They didn't know about the, you know, the individual stories that are within these. You know, there's some, they're all tragic because they've all died, but there are some really tragic, you know, we've got suicides and accidents. So there's one guy in Farcotton Cemetery, at Toaster Road Cemetery, that I do, and he'd served all the way through the war. He'd won the military medal, then he got commissioned, military cross. He'd taken part, he'd organised, had to organise a shooting, shot at dawn situation. He'd done everything, you know, he'd done everything. He came back to England, went down to Colchester, took a girl out on a date and got run over by a taxi and killed a week before the end of the war. There's all sorts of different stories, isn't
there?
It?
Is. Not one there is. Same. Not one the same, and that's what people have an idea of how they think all of these war graves came to be and what these people died of, and actually it's quite often something very unique and very different. So it's really fascinating to be
and
able
we've
to
got lots of people from the Commonwealth that are buried here as well, haven't we? We've got lots of Australians, absolutely, Canadians that either died in RAF accidents, or a lot of them died of flu, or they came back from the Western Front in World War One and died of their wounds here in the hospitals in the UK.
Absolutely. So yeah, from throughout the First World War through to the Second World War, it is a Commonwealth effort. And that was really something that when Sir Fabian Ware founded the organisation, it was really to recognise obviously what was not then known as the Commonwealth, but is now known as the Commonwealth contribution during those two world wars. And that's what our cemeteries and memorials reflect today, is the contribution of all of those men and women who gave their lives during the two world wars. So visiting places like the Runnymede Air Forces Memorial, being an Air Forces memorial with over 20,000 names, you really get that sense, you know, of the Commonwealth contribution with, you know, definitely, people from Canada, Australia, New Zealand, India, the West Indies, South Africa. It really is a Commonwealth memorial in every sense of the word.
Well, it's very exciting, isn't it? It's lots to look for, not just, as you say, during War Graves Week, but right the way through to the armistice in November, and this
absolutely
will happen every year, won't it? But this is
it will.
And they're all up there now, as you said, all the tours are now up on the website. I know you've been very busy putting them up on there. They're all up there now, they're ready to be booked, it's all free, you know, hopefully we'll see you know, thousands of people up and down the country and throughout the world turning up on all these tours. It'd be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that'd be absolutely brilliant. It's exactly what we want.
Excellent, thank you.
Thank you, Terry. It's been great to talk to you.
So that brings to an end this week's podcast. Thank you once again for tuning in. By the time you listen to this, I'll be out on the Western Front guiding. And we normally finish with the last post. But this week I thought I'd do something slightly different, because we've already heard the last post played twice at Harrogate and in Lincolnshire. So what I thought I would do for you is just play those wonderful engines of the Lancaster, and as we listen to the sound of the Lancaster, we've also got the sound of a nightingale bird singing its tune. And as we do that, as we listened to those sounds from the past and from nature, we remember the crew of the Lancaster that crashed in that field in Lincolnshire on the 10th of April 1944.